Good morning. Welcome to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. Dr. Michael McGee here, your host. Happy to have you again for another week of the practice of love. Today we have as our guest Beth Tyson. And Beth Tyson is a trauma-informed a therapist for helping for parenting for children. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Thank you, and thank you for having me today. So happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I'm looking at your new book, A Grand Family for Sullivan, and hearing about your work as a therapist for traumatized children who suffered the trauma of displacement from their parents due to mental illness, addiction, incarceration, those kinds of things. What intense, powerful, difficult, I'm sure at times painful work you were doing.
Yes, it takes a lot to sit with someone's pain, but I found that I was able to do it because I just felt such a deep connection to the people that I worked with, and I really wanted to help support families that are vulnerable and struggling with being impacted by trauma, abuse, neglect. It was hard times.
Mm-hmm. The world so much needs people like you, Beth. How did you find your way into this work?
Sure, yeah, it was kind of, what would you say, serendipitous or just good fortune, or it wasn't planned. It really wasn't planned, but the opportunity came across for me to work for a nonprofit organization to provide in-home therapy for kids and families within the child welfare system and families that were struggling to work through attachment difficulties with the children that they're caring for. So I worked with foster care families, kinship families, which is grandparents or relatives raising other people's children, and also adoptive families. And in that work, I really found my passion. I really didn't know much about it before I got into it, but the more I learned about the complexities of it and the struggles and the love, I mean, just the amount of love and strength that I saw in these families who had faced so much adversity and were able to still find their way in the world and overcome, you know, such tragedy. It was inspiring. And so that's what brought me into that work. And I've just found so much inspiration from the families I've worked with.
Oh, I'm sure. Amazing, amazing. Do you want to share a little bit about your own personal journey to a life of love?
Absolutely. So I lost my mom suddenly in 2005. I was in my mid-20s, and she died in her sleep one night. And that shifted everything for me. That was when I realized that I really wanted to focus on doing something in the world that I love and giving more of my own love back to others. And so I left my career at the time. I was, you know, in my mid-20s, so I was in the business corporate world, and I said, you know what, I'm going back to school. I'm gonna work full time and go to school at night to get my master's degree in counseling and become a counselor, because I had been to counseling myself and found it so beneficial and so helpful, and I really, really loved being a client in therapy and how much it helped me. And I was like, I want to give this gift back to other people. And little did I know what a gift it would be for me. It's funny how it all comes around, but I learned so much from sitting with my clients as they're learning from me. It's a completely two-way street. I often would leave a session and think, wow, I just learned something so important for my own life by listening and hearing the stories and pain of other people.
Oh, yes, it's true. The work really benefits yourself and the people that we work with. It's so true.
Right.
Now you're really an expert in this area of helping children, traumatized children, to heal and recover. I'm wondering, for our listeners who either have experienced trauma growing up themselves or who know of children who are traumatized, or maybe are raising children who have suffered trauma, what are some of the components that you feel are the recipes for raising a resilient child?
Absolutely. That's a great question. For me, I approach it from a place of attachment and trust. So my belief is that when a child is impacted by trauma or has experienced a lot of adversity in their early life, that what is broken down is not who they are as a person, but their trust in the world and themselves and the people around them. And so when we can restore a sense of safety and trust and safe attachment and relationships with safe others, then we can start to the healing process. But really without that, that's kind of the foundation, in my opinion, and people will have different thoughts on that, I'm sure. But for me, I try to approach it as the first step is building trust and safety within the child's life so that they can feel more capable of the bigger tasks in life. Because without a sense of safety and trust in your life, how do you do the bigger tasks, right? How do you love? How do you learn? How do you go to school and focus on math and English when you are afraid for your own well-being and you feel as though you can't trust the adults around you? So I start with that relationship, that trust relationship and attachment.
And how do you do that? How do you build safety and trust in children who have their trust shattered and the experience of the world just being unsafe?
Yes, very patiently. this is, you know, typically these traumas happen over a long term, over a long time of the child's life, maybe years before it has been discovered. And so just like anything, it takes time and patience to work through these things. So it's not something that we can fix overnight, but there are some things that you can do. One is being very predictable and consistent with the child, always letting them know up front what's happening, what's changing in their life. If a routine or a new person is coming into their life, it's very important to prepare them for that and to help to acclimate them to any changes that are happening ahead of time. So really being proactive with new things and people that are coming up. Some of the other things you can do is be as honest as possible with the child. Now, I know we can't always tell young children the full truth or even older children, but if there is an age-appropriate way to explain something to a child, you really need to take that brave step and courageously share with them the truths of their lives that they need to know. So, and there's age-appropriate ways to do that. You know, we don't want to burden a child with too much information. It's about finding a balance. So I help families and organizations and people that work with children find a way to explain some really tough things to these children.
Can you give some examples of some of the tough things that you guys are finding?
Oh, yeah. So a lot of times it was my job as the family therapist for, mm-hmm. say, a foster family or an adoptive family to explain to the child why they couldn't be with mom and dad. You know, that I would have to explain, you know, that mom and dad were not safe or able to take care of them. I'd have to explain, you know, difficult things to children, death, drug abuse, and it can be really, really difficult to do. So those are the things that I would try and help describe and explain in age-appropriate manners. There was one family I worked with that I had to be the one to explain to the child that they were adopted. They didn't even know that they had been adopted.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So, and it's unusual for that to happen, but it does happen. And really, it's not ill-intentioned by the adults in their lives. It's that it can be so hard. And people, adults a lot of times are afraid of doing more damage by telling them the truth. But the truth of that is that really when we are open and honest with children, it helps them to heal and it helps them to understand their life. Because how can you really function at your best if you don't know the truth about your life? That's my perspective anyway.
Okay. So what I hear from what you're saying is the first step in healing the broken world of somebody who's been traumatized as a child is being very predictable and consistent so that they can trust what's going to happen next. And if there's any changes, preparing them for those changes. And in that process, you're being very, very honest with them so that they're not hit by this sort of sense that, oh, you said one thing, but then something else happened, which breaks their sense of trust. These are good rules to go by in our adult relationships, too, I think.
Well, that's what I've found through this work, is that everybody has some level of trauma in their lives, you know, but, you know, most adults don't make it out of their lives untraumatized. There's just so much pain that goes on in the human experience. And so really these skills and these approaches apply to all of us. Really about empathetic, being empathetic and responsive and compassionate, being incredibly compassionate, and trying to think of things from a child's perspective, because we might not ever know what's going on in their mind, and we can't just rely on their behavior. I think we do them a disservice when we just focus on behaviors, and we really need to understand that we may never understand the meaning behind some of the behaviors that we are struggling with our children, but that there is always meaning underneath if you can uncover it. It's much deeper than just what we see on the outside. So keeping that in mind, too, is a critical piece of healing after trauma.
Yes, and again, that applies to all of us adults, too. There's always meaning behind our behavior, beneath our behavior. That's so such a good point. So you're mentioning the first step of healing is building safety and trust, but there's much more to healing trauma than that in building resilience in children, I imagine. What would you say the next step is after establishing safety and trust?
Well, it's all about that attachment piece. So attachment typically forms in the very early stages of life, from 0 to 3. And if a child did not have strong attachment figures in their early childhood, they may have to reestablish a sense of attachment with a new caregiver or somebody who is safe for them. So things that increase attachment, so think about bonding activities and things that bring you closer together as a family and closer together in your relationship. It could be reading books together, spending extra time. I like to recommend, because I do it for in my own family, so I have a daughter who's 5. And, you know, I use a lot of this stuff in my own life to build my relationship with her. So it's not just with children. It's not just with people who have experienced trauma, but it's really for everybody. But it's a trauma lens. It's a little bit different than traditional parenting, I think. And what I do is I intentionally spend 10 minutes a day giving my undivided, non-judgmental, non-directive attention to my daughter, so that she can take in the power of me just being present with her without any expectations, because there's so little of that we actually get in the world and from the people around us, and we desperately need that for our well-being. So one of the things you can do is like spending that undivided, non-judgmental, you know, you're not interfering with the child's play. I just sit and watch her play. I sit right close with her, and I watch her play and interact with a game or a toy or whatever it might be. And I don't try to tell her what to do, or I don't tell her, oh, no, do it this way. I just watch and I sit with her. And that is one of the greatest ways that you can show love to a child and increase bonding and attachment.
So powerful.
Suggest that.
Beautiful, beautiful, so powerful, so true, and not only for children, but in all of our relationships, to give people our undivided, sustained, total attention without judgment is such a loving, loving thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's hard. You know, you don't realize sometimes that you're doing it. I always say, like, as parents, you don't realize sometimes the things that we do that interfere with these bonds. It's not intentional, but we all make these mistakes. But if we can be aware of it and make a different choice, then the long-term impact can be really positive. So, you know, we might interject and say, oh, no, do it this way. And it's well-meaning, you know, but if you just sit and let them unfold in front of you, you'd be amazed at the gift that is for that child, for that emotional well-being and for their development.
Beautiful, beautiful. If we could just backtrack a little bit, Beth, for our audience, and could you explain a little bit for our audience what attachment is and you and I know what attachment disorders are. We live this and breathe it, but a lot of our audience might not really understand, you know, what attachment is. I personally think about attachment as the capacity to safely and securely love and be loved. It's kind of a technical word, attachment, but can you share a little bit more from your professional training for our audience? What is attachment, and what are attachment disorders?
Yeah, sure. So attachment is the natural relationship that develops between an infant and an adult caregiver when they're first born. And so we all need attachment in order to survive. And so in the very beginning of our lives, we look to the people closest to us for safety and trust and for caring for us, because we don't have the ability to care for ourselves. We need people. So what happens is that every time a child has a need and the need gets met by a caregiver, that attachment or that secure relationship is developed. So a child has a need and they cry and you give them a bottle. That increases attachment. It's increasing the child's belief that when they need something, it will be met. That when they have a biological or physical or emotional need, that the people around them are able to be there for them and show up for them and on a consistent basis. So if you have a parent who's very attuned and very in touch and very connected and responsive and warm to a child, and when they cry, they meet the child's need, then attachment typically develops in a healthy way, and it's called secure attachment. If a child has a need and the need is met inconsistently, and the child begins to realize that they don't know when the need is going to be met and when the need isn't going to be met, then a different type of attachment can develop called insecure attachment. And there's variations on that. I go beyond that. There's avoidant and there's
anxious
attachment. Thank you. I'm drawing a blank. Thank you.
And then there's disorganized, right?
Disorganized, yes, disorganized. Thank you. And so what happens is that if a child receives the message that their needs are not going to be met, and the parent really is either harmful to them or hurtful to them, then they develop a type of attachment. And I believe that's the avoidant attachment, when they just realize they've just kind of given up that somebody is going to actually be there for them in a warm and loving way. Some people tend to develop what's called avoidant attachment. So they avoid relationships. They avoid getting close to people because they've learned that that relationships aren't safe. And so
it just hurts too much to be disappointed over and over again, right?
Right, right. It's just like, okay, I can't. And it's a self-preservation that happens in the brain, really. None of these are conscious choices. These things I'm explaining, they're not consciously aware, like, okay, I don't want to get close to people. It's a subconscious thing that's happening where the brain has learned through repeated interactions with their primary caregivers that their needs will not be met either consistently or safely. And because of that, now they have decided that they can't trust adults, they can't trust the people around them, and they are adverse to connecting with others, to developing that deep sense of love and relationship with others, because they just don't trust that it's safe.
Right. So one type is avoidant, where you just say, you know what, I'm not going to get anywhere here. It's too painful to always be disappointed. So I'm going to shut down needing for anything emotional, and I'm just going to be autonomous and take care of myself. That's avoidant, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is an anxious attachment?
So anxious is, I hate you, don't leave me, type of attachment. I like to explain it as where it's like you fluctuate between really needing and wanting someone and wanting their approval and wanting their love and then pushing them away. And
I think of that as more or disorganized. I hate you, don't need me.
Maybe I'm getting them mixed up. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay.
Therapist makes mistakes too, right?
Right. isn't anxious where you go to get your needs met, but then there's always that insecurity about whether you can really trust that you can rely. You're still able to ask, but you don't have that sense of trust that you can rely on.
Right. That's where you're right. I'm so sorry. I got them mixed up. I'm excited talking about this. That's the anxious. The anxious is more people who are feeling insecure that they might feel jealous easily. They might be fearful that they will be rejected, abandoned. Yes, it's that more. That's the anxious, the more of the abandonment and fear of abandonment. And then the disorganized is that other type, which I described earlier as I love you but don't leave me, where you're constantly back and forth between you want this person but then you're pushing them away at the same time.
Thank you for clarifying that. Okay, great, let's take a quick break. You listen to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike and our child trauma expert Beth Tyson talking about restoring the capacity for traumatized children to safely love and be loved in the world. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike, Dr. Michael McGee, your host, with our child trauma expert, Beth Tyson. Welcome back, Beth.
Thank you so much.
By the way, I just want to mention for our audience that if you go to Beth Tyson, TYSON.com, Beth has a great video where she talks about her book about grandparents. The name of the book again, Beth?
It's A Grand Family for Sullivan. And I wrote the book for relatives that are suddenly caring for children due to the opioid epidemic and incarceration and mental health issues. Yeah.
Yeah, so good. Okay, so I invite you all to look at that. So we've been talking a little bit about helping children to heal from trauma, and you've mentioned the first step of building safety and trust, which is just a profound general rule about healing from trauma, is forming safe and trusting connections. And then out of that sense of safety and trust, you talked about intentionally doing things to create what we call sort of a secure attachment, where you're able to be safely connected and ask people to meet your needs and share with them how you're feeling and have a sense that it's safe and okay. And you mentioned something very powerful about really giving somebody your undivided attention, and you used the phrase the power of presence, which I just love, the power of presence without expectations or judgment. Just beautiful. Do you have any other suggestions on how to help children heal and develop resilience?
Absolutely. So I think, I'm really big on teaching young children and people in general about emotions and about mental health. It's a topic and a discussion that we sort of have been shying away from for at least most of my life anyway, but now it's come to the forefront. Mental health is really being talked about in the media and in the general population because of COVID-19. I feel like it's really been brought up, and everybody is sort of more aware now of the impact of trauma because, COVID is a form of an adverse experience that can lead to trauma. So, so there's some things that we can do. One of the things I like to do is teaching kids about mental health, teaching them about their brain and how their brain works, and teaching them about mindfulness and the coping skills that you can use to manage your fears and your anxiety. And it starts off with very young children, teaching them about what emotions are by reflecting how they're feeling. So one of the other ways to build attachment when if a child is struggling with it is mirroring the child's emotions. So if a child is sad, you're not laughing, you're sad with them. If a child is angry, you might not be angry back, but you are like, You say, you look really mad right now. You seem like you feel angry right now. So it's validating their experiences, helps to teach them about their emotions and what they're feeling in their body, and then asking them, like, where do you feel that in your body? So my daughter's 5, and I'll do that with her. If she's really angry, I'll say, you look really angry right now. And she might say, yeah, I'm angry. And then I'll say, where do you feel it in your body? And so connecting the brain and the body together, the emotions with the sensations in the body, because that's what emotions are. They're uncomfortable or comfortable emotions. They're not good or bad, but they're different types of emotions. So I teach coping skills, and in the back of my book, A Grand Family for Sullivan, I teach a really simple four steps. It's called RATS. And it's remember that big feelings are a natural part of life, and it's okay to have scary thoughts and feelings. So that's R, remember that big feelings are a natural part of life. Ask is the A, and it's ask to take a break if you feel upset. Take a minute to scribble or do jumping jacks or squeeze your body tight. And then the T for rats is tell. Tell a friend, teacher, a parent how you're feeling. Talking about how you feel helps your body relax, or you can even tell it to your journal. Writing down how you're feeling can be incredibly powerful and therapeutic. And then stop is S. Stop what you're doing and notice one thing you can feel, hear, see, or smell, and that's called a grounding activity. If somebody is really feeling panicked and triggered by a traumatic memory, grounding is what can really bring them back into the present moment. So you would look around the room and notice things that relate to your five senses. So I can see, my dresser. I can see the trees outside. I can see, you know, the carpet on the floor. And you would pick out five things, and then five things you could hear and five things that you can feel. And that helps ground you back into the present moment and relieve some of the anxiety you're feeling. So teaching kids important coping skills like that can be beneficial. But I want to give you a chance to respond.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks, Beth. Yeah, thank you. So this is, like, really, really profound. My reflection on what you're saying is this part of mindfulness, which is to stop in and notice what you're experiencing, right? And and to notice your feelings. And we live in a society where we talk about sort of negative feeling and positive, and there's almost a social assumption that we're programmed to assume. It's a hidden assumption that painful feelings are bad. And what I hear that's very powerful in your work is teaching people that feelings are not good or bad. They're either uncomfortable or comfortable. Very, very powerful and invalidating painful experiences. You know, I had wonderful parents, but they weren't perfect. And when I was growing up, I think because of their own programming and their own socialization, they really had the idea that you know, it was really children, it was bad for children to be angry or upset. Mm-hmm. So in terms of those four primary emotions, I like to think of emotions as being either sad, mad, glad, or afraid as the four core primary emotions. Sad, mad, glad, or afraid. And when I was growing up, and I think a lot of us when we were growing up, if you were sad or mad, you got the message that was bad. Sad and mad meant bad. You were bad. Mm-hmm. That was bad. Painful emotions were bad. And I think, you know, when I grew up, if I cried, if I was really upset about something, rather than mirroring my emotions, my mom and dad would say to me, "Stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about." And then sad turned immediately to afraid. And so I became, you know, personally afraid of my sad emotions or my angry, oh, boy, there was no room for being angry. Mm-hmm. In my family growing up, that was very dangerous. So I just love what you're doing here, Beth, in terms of helping these traumatized children. And really this applies to all of us and all children. All of our relationship is mirroring and validating and reflecting back to these children what they feel, because what you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, is that a lot of these children don't even probably know what they're feeling until you mirror it back. Is that true?
I think so. I think they may not be consciously aware of what they're feeling until it is mirrored back to them. So it can be really helpful to help them develop an understanding of their emotional world when you mirror back to a child what it is that they look like. And you don't have to be definitive about it. You can say, "You look like you're feeling angry." You don't say, "You're angry," and label, you know, because maybe it's not anger, maybe it is fear, because they can look similar. You know, fear and anger can look similar. But if you check in and you say, "You look like you're feeling angry," then they have a chance to correct you and say, "No, I'm really afraid," or "No, I don't feel good, my belly hurts," or they have a chance to speak for themselves about what it is, but at the same time, you're at least mirroring back to them what you're seeing helps them connect their feelings and their body to their thoughts and their mind and develop a sense of emotional intelligence.
Yeah, that's so helpful. We have to take a break shortly, but I'm very aware of research that was done on the importance of mirroring back to young children their feelings, and it was a experiment where one child would sort of fall on the playground, and then they would look at their mom to see how they were supposed to feel. And if the mother would go, "Oh, you're okay," and smile, and say, "Everything's okay," then the child would get up and they'd be fine. But if the mother would, like, give them a horrified look, like, oh, my God, then the child would start crying. And they were using the mother to figure out what they were supposed to feel at that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, this mirroring is so important to help children learn how to identify and know their feelings. Well, good. Well, let's take a quick break. And you're listening to How to Love Show with Dr. Mike and our guest, Beth Tyson. who is an expert at helping children with trauma. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike, Dr. Michael McGee, your host. We're talking today with our child trauma expert, Beth Tyson. Welcome back, Beth.
Thank you so much.
You know, last before the break, you were talking about that it's such an important role that we have in terms of helping children learn about their brains and their emotions and teaching them mindfulness. What a radically wonderful thing. And I loved what you talked about teaching them about rats and that feelings are good and natural, and to ask if they need a time out, if they're overwhelmed, and tell somebody how they're feeling, and to ground themselves by noticing one thing they stop and one thing they feel, see, hear, or smell. Do you have other suggestions for how to help boost resilience in children?
Absolutely. So this is like really near and dear to my heart, talking about how to build resilience in children. And I think it really starts with a shift in our thinking of children from noticing that they are completely whole human beings with capabilities beyond what we would ever maybe imagine or the way that we were raised as children. And so one of the things that I like to recommend and that I see to be helpful is showing children our own vulnerability. When you show a child your own struggles, that you struggle with things and that you fail sometimes, then they begin to learn that that's the normal thing to do. And same goes for not only just failures or trying and to keep going after a setback, but with your emotions. So, you know, if my daughter is feeling really afraid at nighttime, one of the things that I found that helped her more than anything is me sharing a story about when I was a kid and I was afraid of the dark. And so I share with her my own childhood struggles, and I tell her what my mom did, and I tell her about things that I'm still afraid of now, you know, and again, age-appropriate ways. You don't need to overburden the child with too much of that adult fear, but you can share enough to help them show them that it's normal to have these feelings, and you normalize it for them. And that actually does build their resilience and their ability to overcome difficult feelings when they know that they're not alone in the way that they're feeling. And so that gives people inner strength. And sharing your own vulnerability. Also, you can show them something you're struggling with. If you want to have like an actual activity where, you know, you try to put something really hard together in front of them. Because as adults, a lot of our struggles and a lot of things we work at are behind closed doors, or they're at work where our kids don't see us struggling to learn something new. But intentionally trying to learn something new, learning a new skill, or, you know, working on a really hard puzzle, or trying to put something together that's challenging, and let them watch you struggle with it, and show them that you can stick it out to the end, and that even though it's frustrating, that you will stick with it and get through it. And those are lessons for life that, you know, when you persevere and you persist at something, eventually you will learn it, and that you just have to keep trying. So I like to recommend, puzzles, anything that has like an end result. So whether it be beading a necklace, you know, you start with one bead and you put it on a string, and it can be tough to get it through those little bead holes, but you stick it out, you get to the end, and at the end you have a finished product, and it feels really satisfying. And one of the other things that I share is the power of letting your child struggle. So letting them figure things out on their own and using the power of wait. So instead of jumping in to rescue a child who might be getting, you know, frustrated, waiting a few extra seconds to see if they can actually do whatever it is that they're trying to do. So the easiest example is with walking. When a child is learning to walk, you know, you have options. You can pick them up and hold them and guide them and hold their hands and teach them how to walk that way. Or you can sit back and watch and observe and watch them struggle a little bit to pull themselves up on a couch or a chair. And eventually their legs get enough strength and they can begin to, you know, move along while holding on. And so you don't necessarily have to jump in. You can be there to guide and support, but letting them have their opportunities to make accomplishments on their own, it's the best feeling in the world. You know, even as adults, myself, like if I do something myself and on my own, it's like, wow, I have this inner sense of pride and joy. But if somebody, you know, helps me get there, or if I had extra help, or assistance. Sometimes it's like, oh, yeah, that's good, I did it, but, you know, so-and-so helped me. And if you want to build inner strength and resiliency, you need to give children enough opportunities to feel success on their own, because that drives your inner motivation to want to do it again. So those are some of the things I start with.
Wonderful. Yeah, good. So I'm hearing really show them, you know, through stories of our own struggles, that it's normal to struggle, that none of us had perfect lives. And I'm hearing you really talk about sort of modeling our own struggles with them, even in the present, and helping mm-hmm. them, helping to show them as we struggle maybe with something like a difficult puzzle. But I'm also hearing you saying that, you know, really let them have challenges and experience their own confidence in being able to overcome those challenges.
Yeah, and that can be hard, you know, to sit back and wait as parents, you know, it's like, oh, I just want to help. I just want to put my hand there and push them up the ladder, you know, and that's fine, too. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying if you can give opportunities for them to do it on their own. There were so many moments, and there still are, where, you know, I want to solve the problem for my daughter, but if I just wait one extra minute, and I don't always do it because I'm not perfect either. I make plenty of mistakes, and I struggle with my own parenting at times, but if sometimes when I just wait one more minute, or I say, hey, can you give it one more try, and then she gets it on that try, and then the look in her eyes and on her face just says it all. You know, it's like that sense of accomplishment, that pride, that confidence that was built in that moment is really, you know, better than anything I could give her by helping her do it. Now, of course, she's always safe when she's doing, you know, it's nothing unsafe, and I'm there to spot her if it's climbing or anything else. But yeah, it's guiding and it's being supportive instead of jumping in to do it for them or rescue them right away.
Right, being guiding and supportive. Yeah, I've heard people talk about sort of that optimal challenge, window of optimal challenge. You want to give people challenges which are not like so easy that there's no struggle, but not, you don't want to give children challenges that are so hard that they're impossible for them to do.
Yes, exactly. And you need to use your discernment as a parent too. Like, what are they getting over frustrated? Well, then maybe they need a break. And maybe they need to come back to it in a few minutes, you know? And then, so it's not so much of giving up as it is, you know, we'll come back to this later.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to ask you about, Beth, because it's really important for trauma, as I understand it, and before we end with you for today, is, you know, a lot of times when traumatic things happen, my understanding is that children can take on the idea that somehow they're bad. Bad things happen,
yeah.
So I'm bad. And you haven't really mentioned that yet, but is there a need to sort of develop a new story or a new narrative or understanding of the bad things that happen in a way that is not linked to them feeling bad about themselves? Is that any part of the work that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So children will make up their own stories in their minds to make sense of the world around them. And typically children are focused on themselves, and so they just assume that everything that happens is because of them. It's just, it's a thing that our brain goes through developmentally, and you might know the name or the term for it that I don't have, but it's like you're kind of, as a young person, you're self-centered. You think the whole world happens around you, and so really rebuilding that story. And I think that goes back to being really honest and truth and telling the truth to children so that they don't make up stories that aren't true in their own minds about it being their fault, because it's never the child's fault. We need to boost them up and helping them understand that it wasn't their fault. So you can do that. I mean, one of the things I like to do is letting children overhear you saying something good about them. And that's just something little that I know we're towards the end of our session here, but you can let a child overhear you saying something good about them, and that can be a quick way to help them start to change the narrative in their life. So if they're in the other room and you're on the phone with, you know, an aunt, a friend, or whoever, and you start mentioning something really great that they've done lately, you know, it's little moments like that will build up a different story for them.
What a brilliant suggestion. Yeah. Well, Beth, we have to close for today. But I want to thank you for being on the show, and I just want to say I'm so impressed by both your wisdom and your compassion, the two wings of love. And thank you for bringing that to our audience today. Do you want to tell us again how our audience can learn more about you?
Sure. So I am Beth Tyson. It's B-E-T-H-T-Y-S-O-N, and I have a website. It's BethTyson.com, and on there you can see all my articles on trauma-informed parenting, trauma-informed care, and I offer consulting to organizations, schools, hospitals, nonprofit organizations that work with children and families to help them understand trauma and help them, you know, look at children and look at life through a trauma-transformed lens. So
wonderful.
Yeah,
I love that. Trauma-transformed lens. Wonderful. Well, Beth, may you be safe. May you be well. May you continue to benefit the world as you are and continue the life above your living. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
It's been great. You're listening to the How to Love Show. Stay tuned. I'll be right back with the final segment of the show right after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike, Dr. Michael, Mickey, your host. If you'd like to learn more about me and my work, which really focuses on healing and growth and transformation, you can visit howtolove.com. So I really enjoyed our conversation with Beth. She, as I've said, she really is a source of tremendous wisdom and compassion in terms of her being moved, called to help heal traumatized children. And I was thinking about her comments about really the healing is really in it. If you look at it, it's really in establishing a loving, safe, healing connection with these children, and the idea that really connection heals. You know, there's different types of connection that we have, not only to each other, but also to other aspects of our experience. We can connect with our physical sensations. Beth talked about connecting to feelings, sensations, what you see, what you hear, what you feel. There's a way that we can be mindful of our thinking and our urges. There's a way as we get more spiritually in tune and we get into the sense of connection with stillness and awareness, almost a sense of connection with the sacred. And all of these channels of connection are really critical for living a wise and skillful and loving life. So in terms of practicing connecting with other people, the connection really, I think, is at the foundation of loving. And most of people really heal really through developing a way to be attached, as they use clinically, developing a secure attachment in which you can sort of safely and securely and effectively connect and love and be loved. And so it's really so important that, you know, Beth mentioned about really giving people our undivided attention without judgment or expectation or any kind of agenda, but just literally to see and to know somebody, to really see them and to understand them. We've talked a little bit in the past about empathy, that is really making an effort to ask questions, to maybe inquire about how somebody is feeling. That's so, people love it when we do that with them. So it looks like maybe you're feeling a little bit anxious about whatever is happening in your life. And Beth made the point that you don't tell people what they're feeling. I thought that was really important. You ask, or you say, it seems like you may be feeling sad right now, or maybe you're mad about this. And then if you don't get it right, then people can come back and correct you. But it's just such a wonderful feeling and such a gift you can give other people to ask them what you about their experience and what you may experience in essence. That is really connect. You know, so much of the time when we're connecting with other, we're so busy talking about our own experience and our own thoughts. And if you look very honestly at human conversation, a lot of times somebody will be talking, and we're not paying 100% attention to what we're saying. We're thinking about what we're going to say. Our minds sort of automatically react to what we hear, but then going to what we want to say. it's real. It sounds simple, but it can be very difficult to just pay attention. Just listen without, you know, without getting lost in our own thinking about what it is that we might want to say. And really to spend more energy not in trying to be heard and to express ourselves, although that's important to be able to do, that's very important to do, especially if we're hurting and are in need of help, but also to really balance that with time and energy inquiring and learning and deepening our understanding of other people. But sometimes I, in my work with patients who are anxious in relationships, there's this great fear of maybe saying something stupid or being seen that they're anxious about whether they're going to be approved or valued by the people that they're talking about, or the people will judge them negatively and think that they're dumb or stupid, and they carry all this fear about how they'll be judged or regarded by others, which really crowds out the ability to connect, because then there's absolutely no investment of energy into seeking to understand another person. So one of the things that I recommend for that is to really go in with an intention of just seeing another human being as a mystery and wanting to uncover and discover and learn more without judgment, deepening understanding of the other person. I think in our current society right now, with the polarization that we have between the different Democratic parties and the demonization that we have of our different ways of perceiving the world, this need for empathic, non-judgmental connection is more important than ever. I know I have a brother, Mark, who is really extremely, extremely conservative and really lays out a very extreme far-right kind of ideology. And I feel such a sense of an urgent need, really, to forge a way for us and our family to be able to find ways to deeply understand each other and to deeply connect, even if we disagree. But to know, to have him know that I understand him and that I honor and respect what it is that he feels and values perhaps is more important to him, even though I might not agree or have different values. And it goes the other way, too. It's so important to seek out mutual relationships where other people who deeply want to understand us and validate and affirm us, our wants and our needs and our dreams and our fears, that we might be understood and comforted and helped in love. So I think going forward in the world, it's so important that we create intentionally, consciously, and work on developing connections where we are seen and where we see, where we are known and where we know, where this goes both ways. And if we can find that back and forth flow of understanding and love and affirmation and respect and affection, it just really makes life so deeply fulfilling. So yeah. So in any case, this is really. I hope the session today was good. The show today was good for you in terms of thinking about children. I think that what Beth suggested for helping children to heal are really relevant guidelines for helping all of us to heal. So may we take her wisdom and carry it forward into our connections and relationships. I hope you have a good week, a week of love, and look forward to having you back next week. Until then, take care.